For more
KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The governor showed his priorities yesterday. He wants to continue to spend on health care for illegal immigrants, billions and billions of dollars.
Some states, like California and Minnesota, are cutting programs that provide health care to low-income immigrants.
For Friday, May 16th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Russia and Ukraine agreed to a prisoner swap, but so far, no major progress on a ceasefire.
There needs to be a strong reaction, including sanctions against Russia's energy sector and banks.
Also, the WNBA season tips off today. We'll have a preview.
It's different in the W. You don't see teams going undefeated. You don't see a lot of single loss seasons. So it's definitely going to be an adjustment.
And the host of the only locally produced late night talk show in the country steps down.
Danny Cashman of The Night Show in Maine says goodbye after 15 years.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Supreme Court has weighed in on President Trump's use of an 18th century law to remove a group of Venezuelan immigrants. Justices, with just two dissenting votes temporarily blocking the administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act, continue to fast-track deportations of Venezuelan men or halt fast-track deportations of men been accused of being gang members. Mayor Sergio Martinez Beltran says it's a blow to the administration's efforts and could be a prelude to larger issues.
It is a significant loss for President Trump. Remember, he's pledged to remove millions of migrants without legal status from the U.S., and the Alien Enemies Act is one of the tools he's using. He's already removed more than 100 Venezuelans under this law, and they've been sent to El Salvador, not even their home countries. And there are still unresolved questions. The big one is whether the use of the Alien Enemies Act is legal or not. And that's a question the courts and potentially the Supreme Court will have to answer at some point.
NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran. President Trump is touting billions of dollars in new artificial intelligence deals with the United Arab Emirates. As NPR's Bob Bone explains, it was part of the president's Middle East tour where he emphasized investments over foreign policy.
Qualcomm says it's developing a new global engineering center focused on AI in Abu Dhabi. Amazon said it will help boost cloud services in the country, and a new AI campus will be built aiming to make the UAE a regional hub for tech. It follows the White House celebrating another flurry of business deals in Saudi Arabia. In both cases, details remain murky, and some of the agreements had been in the works before this week's announcement. Some others predate Trump's presidency altogether. Still, Trump is taking credit. The White House said this week that Trump is, quote, the deal maker in chief. Silicon Valley executives support the agreements with the authoritarian states, hoping the oil-rich countries can help power the next wave of AI. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
A closely watched survey of consumer sentiment finds the lowest rate of confidence in the economy in 3 years. As Quinn Kleinfelder of member station WDET reports, the results show increasing fears about the effects of President Trump's tariffs on inflation.
The University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index dropped just a bit since last month. But the director of the survey, Joanne Hsu, says after a brief bump following President Trump's election, consumers' confidence in the economy has steadily declined, especially as the U.S. has opened new fronts in its trade wars.
People are concerned that inflation is going to come roaring back. And inflation has been the number one thing on people's minds for several years now. And they're really worried and concerned about cost of living.
Hsu says a more complete picture should emerge at the end of the month when results will reflect consumer response to the U.S. scaling back tariffs on China. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Stocks gained ground to close out a winning week on Wall Street. The Dow was up 331 points. The Nasdaq rose 98 points. This is NPR. The head of the company that makes the weight loss drug Wegovy says he is stepping down. Lars Fruergaard Jorgensen, CEO of Danish pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk, announcing his decision to leave the company, coming by mutual agreement with the company's board. The announcement follows Novo Nordisk citing recent market challenges and a sharp drop in its share price. Novo Nordisk last week downgraded its sales and profit forecast and has been seen its share price falling by more than 50% since the middle of last year. Scientists say they've uncovered some secrets about how flamingos feed. As NPR's Jeff Bromfield reports, it's not as elegant as you may think.
Flamingos are graceful, iconic birds until it's dinner time. This video from the San Diego Zoo captures just how weird they look when they eat. They bob their heads in and out of the water, chatter their bills, and stomp their feet. Victor Ortega Jimenez is a researcher at UC Berkeley.
One obvious question is, what are they doing with their feet? People say that they are dancing.
It turns out they're not. Ortega Jimenez worked with a group at Georgia Tech that showed the foot stomping, beak chattering, and bobbing was all designed to stir up and trap tiny shrimp and other food in the water. The food gets swept up in swirling vortices, then the flamingo scoops it up with its bill. The work appears in this week's edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices edged higher at week's end. Oil up 87 cents a barrel to settle at $62.49 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A handful of states, including California, Minnesota, and Illinois, offer access to health insurance to low-income immigrants, regardless of age or legal status. That amounts to millions of people covered. Well, now, leaders of some of those states, including prominent Democrats, are attempting to change course. This week, Governor Gavin Newsom suggested cuts to California's program while staring down a $12 billion deficit. And yesterday, Minnesota Democrats erupted in protest. After former vice presidential candidate and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz proposed a rollback to his state's program.
On the issue of Medicaid, that's exactly right. The cuts at the federal level, specifically dealing with Medicaid.
We are joined now by two reporters following the story where they are. Laura Fitzgerald at Cap Radio in Sacramento and Dana Ferguson at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
So let's start with you, Dana. Obviously, there are some people with very strong feelings about this in Minnesota, given those very loud protests yesterday. To the extent that you can understand, why are these states reversing course on these programs, you think?
Yeah, there are a couple of factors at play here. The first is state budgets. States are in a tough place financially. Revenues in many places were already down, and Congress is eyeing big cuts to states as they negotiate spending. So leaders just don't have a lot of wiggle room. The other thing is considered sort of the elephant in the room, and that's that Republicans in Congress are proposing additional cuts directed at states that provide health care to people without legal status. So Minnesota could face financial penalties.
Right. But are Democrats in Minnesota even saying this is about getting ahead of those kinds of federal penalties?
No. Walz and legislative leaders say that wasn't a factor. We have a really unique situation right now where our legislature is just about split down the middle, 101 Democrats and 100 Republicans. So there had to be bipartisan compromise. The proposal in Minnesota right now says kids can stay in the program, but Republicans here wanted to eliminate the healthcare program entirely. That would mean everyone without legal status, citing concerns about higher than expected enrollment and costs. There are about 20,000 people enrolled now, and 3,000 of those are kids. Governor Walz talked about how tough this deal was at the news conference where lawmakers protested outside.
I'm not going to sugarcoat how difficult this was. Then these lawmakers are there. They have their voice heard. We'll vote on this. We didn't expect everybody to be happy in this. I think many of us compromised.
And I should note, it still needs to get voted on by the legislature. It's not a sure thing yet.
Okay. Well, Laura, let's go to you in California, because Governor Newsom came out just Wednesday and announced a $12 billion deficit in this state and cuts to this program. What's been the reaction since then?
Yeah, well, Democratic lawmakers out here aren't having quite the reaction that they did in Minnesota, at least not yet. Some members of the legislature's Latino caucus are pushing back on the freeze and say the state should look for other areas to cut. The program out here would stop enrolling new immigrants without legal status in January next year and would also begin charging a $100 a month fee for each individual. But also, like Minnesota, kids could stay on Medi-Cal. That's what we call Medicaid. Republicans are actually using those details against Newsom. They're saying that his budget proposal actually allows the state to keep spending on coverage for these individuals by allowing them to enroll through the end of the year. Republican Assembly Minority Leader James Gallagher had this to say.
And the governor showed his priorities yesterday. He wants to continue to spend on health care for illegal immigrants, billions and billions of dollars.
I mean, Laura, we are talking about a lot of immigrants in the state on this program, right? So what could this mean for healthcare overall in California?
It's not exactly clear how many folks will end up leaving the program, for instance, if the $100 copay ends up being cost prohibitive for them. But Newsom says he thinks these rollbacks will lead to around $86 million in savings this year, and that'll grow to about $3.3 billion in savings moving forward. We do know that 1.6 million people signed up for Medi-Cal under the expansion to those without legal status, and that's more than the state expected. Some experts and lawmakers, including Newsom, they've pointed out that the state ends up paying for coverage either way because those without health insurance end up seeking care in emergency rooms. So some lawmakers and advocates, mainly hospitals and immigrant rights advocates, they pushed for this expansion to increase access to regular care for this community, like doctor's visits and prescription medications.
That is Laura Fitzgerald at CAP Radio in Sacramento and Dana Ferguson at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thank you to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
WNBA season tips off tonight. By almost every measure, last season was an enormous success for the league. Attendance was up, ratings were up, and now the league is hoping that viewers will be tuning back in for more. Well, I certainly will, and I know NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan will be too. Hey, Becky.
Hey, Juana.
So, Becky, we're both super excited about this, but tell the folks what we've got to look forward to here.
Yeah, I mean, well, as you alluded to, totally going to be potentially a game-changing season for the WNBA as the league is trying to cash in on this boom of interest that they saw last year. And so there's this major new broadcast lineup that includes, for the first time, regular season games on primetime network TV, building on last year's WNBA finals between the New York Liberty and the Minnesota Lynx, which was an incredible series. There were more than 3.3 million viewers at the peak for Game 5. That's more than many NBA games get. So that's just the baseline that they're going to be trying to build on for next year. Those two teams, Liberty and Lynx, are expected to be great again, along with the Las Vegas Aces and their megastar, Asia Wilson, of course. And then the Indiana Fever, of course, made a bunch of major offseason moves to try to seize their opportunity this year with Caitlin Clark going into year two and see if they can contend for a title.
I don't know, Becky, sounds like possibly an MVP battle between those two. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think you do have to start with the presumption that it's Asia Wilson's award to lose. She's won three of the last five. She's the absolutely dominant center for the Aces. And last year, she won it unanimously. She's only 28 also, so still totally fully in her prime. I think we also have to mention in this conversation Nafisa Collier, who's the star for the Minnesota Lynx. And yet the betting favorite is neither of them. It is Caitlin Clark, who was excellent in the second half of last season and still has room to grow.
I mean, I can't talk to you without talking about the rookie Paige Beckers as she won a championship with the University of Connecticut. What are you expecting to see from her in the pros?
Yeah, I think, well, I'm really looking forward to watching her. I think there's always an adjustment period for rookies coming into any professional league, especially WNBA. It's never wise to expect too much of them. But, you know, Dallas, they only won 9 games last season, the Dallas Wings. And so I think an upward trajectory is in the cards for them. Paige Becker, she spoke a little bit to this sort of adjustment last week. There's a physical adjustment as, you know, the WNBA is more physical than college ball. Her game especially is like this finesse kind of guard game. There's also a mental adjustment, a more rigorous season. And, you know, for the first time, she's not playing for UConn, one of the best teams. She's playing for a team that only won 9 games last season. She talked about that a little bit last week.
It's different in the W. You don't see teams going undefeated. You don't see a lot of single loss seasons. So it's definitely going to be an adjustment. You never want to get used to losing, but you want to get used to learning from games and moving forward.
Yeah, so basically in the first time of her career, she's not only not the hottest thing in the league, she's not even the best player on her own team potentially, but she's an early favorite for Rookie of the Year, and that alone, if she can get it done, would be quite the accomplishment.
Indeed. Well, speaking of accomplishments, we said earlier that the league itself just had an incredible season last year. What have they got to do to build on that?
Well, they're about to enter a period of major expansion. So this season, we'll see the debut of a new WNBA team for the first time since 2008. That team is the Golden State Valkyries. They're going to add two more teams next season, one in Toronto, one in Portland. The plan is to add a 16th team in time for 2028. That's a lot of growth. And so, you know, for these new teams, I think it's hard for any expansion team to compete, really. So the measure of success is going to be building the fan base. Can they sell out of games? Will people in these cities be out and about wearing gear? Will they be talking about the team? I think that is key for building a foundation on which these new teams can improve and contend. And if they can do so, maybe that's a rising tide that can lift all boats across the league.
NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration is investigating former FBI Director James Comey over a social media post of seashells on a beach. Republicans say that it was a threat to the president, which Comey denies. NPR's Rachel Treisman explains.
Comey has long been an outspoken critic of President Trump, who fired him in 2017. On Thursday, Comey posted a picture from a beach walk of shells forming the numbers 8647. While it's not clear who arranged them, those numbers have appeared elsewhere, on anti-Trump bumper stickers and protest signs. 86 is a slang term from the service industry that generally means to throw out or refuse service. Recently, and less frequently, it is used to mean kill. Trump is the 47th president. Trump administration officials and allies accuse Comey of calling for the president's assassination. Comey said he didn't realize some associate those numbers with violence and has since taken down the post. NPR has contacted him for comment. Republican critics don't believe Comey, including Trump, as he told Fox News.
He knew exactly what that meant. A child knows what that meant. If you're the FBI director and you don't know what that meant assassination.
Trump survived two assassination attempts as a candidate in 2024, which Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard acknowledged on Fox News.
I'm very concerned for his life, and James Comey, in my view, should be held accountable and put behind bars for this.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem announced Thursday night that her department and the Secret Service are investigating the matter. A Secret Service spokesperson told NPR it, quote, takes rhetoric like this very seriously. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. You probably know the names Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert. Their late night shows reach national audiences, but Maine has its very own voice of late night, Danny Cashman.
From the Gracie Theater in Bangor and broadcasting all over the state, it's Maine's only late night talk show. The Night Show with Danny Cashman.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome to The Night Show. My name is Dan.
Airing Saturday nights in Maine's top three TV markets, The Night Show has all of the trappings of those other late night shows, opening monologue, studio audience, celebrity guests, but with an emphasis on the state of Maine. According to Cashman, it is the only locally produced late night talk show in the country, but after 15 years, he is calling it quits, so we brought him on to talk about that decision and to reflect on his experiences hosting The Night Show. Danny Cashman, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you, Juana. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we know that you've already taped your last episode, which, as we said, will air on Saturday. I just want to know, how are you feeling in this moment? How does it feel to be closing the doors on The Night Show?
It was very bittersweet, I have to say. But the way that we were able to close this up has been sort of a dream storybook ending for us. And I think in comedy, timing is everything. And I think in television, it can be said the same. And I think we timed it just right. And just in the past few weeks, I've kind of come to a different level of peace with how we are wrapping this up now that it's right ahead of us.
How did you make the decision? Was there a moment where you just knew it was finally time to sign off?
There were a few moments, and I don't think any one of them was more significant than another, but they all sort of brought me to the same conclusion. One moment, my computer died on me that I used to edit the show the day I had to get a 1-hour Christmas special and our regular edition of our show off to the stations. And it was the day before Christmas Eve. So I was in the office by myself trying to fix a computer, which I can't do, late into the evening. I finally did get the show off to the stations, but I thought to myself, this is not probably the best way to live one's life. But in a more reflective way, I started this show when I was 19 years old, an earlier version of the show. And my parents were 47 and they dropped everything to help me live out this dream. And now I'm 47. I have a couple of kids. Life is busy. I want to make sure that I have that same ability to drop everything and help my kids with their dreams if they come up with some crazy idea like starting a TV show.
I mean, that's incredible. That schedule has to be hectic. If I remember correctly, you still have a full-time job, right?
Yeah, I'm a public relations person by day. And I also have a nonprofit that I've co-founded. I'm the chair of that. And the TV show has been, it's been a stress reliever. It's been a dream. It's been everything that just kind of pulled me out of the day-to-day difficulties of work to be able to do something different.
Now, many of our listeners probably associate late night interview shows with those national names from Johnny Carson to the Jimmys, but your show is a local show for a local audience. How is that different?
Definitely more of an emphasis on local. We have local personalities, athletes, coaches, but we also have been able to bring in the occasional national person. We've had Patrick Dempsey. We had Ed Asner. We've had Paula Cole perform. And our final guest last weekend, it was my idol, David Letterman, and he came to our show as a surprise. Our audience did not know he was coming. Another idol of mine is Mark Summers, and he hosted Double Dare when I was a kid, but he's done 1,000 things since then, both in front of the camera, behind the camera. He's been on Broadway, and he's done our show several times. So we've been lucky to kind of bring people in like that who have an appeal that goes beyond the state's borders. But then we do local comedy and local monologue jokes, local sketches. We do jokes about local dive bars that people in the state would understand. It might not hit as well to somebody in Dubuque, but in Maine, it seems to go pretty well.
Now, we actually have some tape from that episode where David Letterman came to your show. I know that aired last weekend. We'll play it.
Thank you. I understand you're leaving the show.
I'm leaving the show, yeah.
I have a couple of thoughts, a couple of things to say. First of all, are you certain? Are you sure? Are you leaving to spend more time with your family? And if that's the reason, you might want to check with your family.
And Dan Cashman, I know from being in this job, we get so few of those opportunities where you get to be face-to-face and talk to and interview someone that you admire. I just, what was the experience like of having him on the show as your final celebrity guest?
My head is still spinning from it, to be honest. It was equal parts surreal and unreal. Through the entire course of this show, I've tried to sort of emulate the people that I grew up watching. Letterman first and foremost, Johnny Carson I somehow found after I found Letterman, and Conan are the three pillars for me, for late night talk show people. And I try to emulate them. So in the moment, I was trying to think back to when David Letterman had Johnny Carson on his show the first time. And I was just trying to do my best to portray a late night talk show host. And I'll say, as soon as he walked off stage, he disappeared sort of behind a doorway we have set up. And I went right back to being fanboy. And I took a deep breath and I couldn't believe what had just happened. And the audience that we had in place, who had no idea that he was coming, gave a pretty lengthy standing ovation. And that got very emotional for me. My head was swirling. And I realized at some point when they stopped clapping, I probably have to say something. Mm-hmm. And my head was blank. All I could say after a little bit of a pause was thank you. I didn't really know what else to say. And I think at some point in time, I'll be able to process all of that, but I still haven't gotten there yet.
Final episode hasn't aired yet, but I wonder, what do you want from that final episode to leave your audience with? What are some of the notes that you hope to hit?
I really want to make sure that the audience understands how impactful the relationship has been that we've had with the students and the staff at the New England School of Communications at Hudson University. The students have been the people running the cameras and running the audio and doing the backstage prep. And they go from that program on to work world-class events. So we have a little bit of a clip package ready to go that includes some of that. And I want people to maybe see it the way that I've seen it. See this as a love letter to Maine, a love letter to Bangor, where we are based, but a love letter to Maine. We've tried hard to have fun on television. That's been our main goal, but to do it with a local angle, especially today. There's so much divisiveness. There's so many people who are angry with each other or angry with things. And yeah, we make fun of some politics, but we make fun of everything. And we try to do it in a way that's lighthearted and fun and not with any sort of agenda. And I hope that that's given people a chance to relax a little bit before they go to bed when they watch our show.
Dan Cashman, host of Maine's The Night Show. Its final episode airs tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us. And Dan, congratulations.
Thank you, Juana. Thank you again for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Christopher Moore's latest novel, Anima Rising, brings together some characters from history and others who were not quite.
I often do these extended afterwards in the book that says, this is true, this isn't. And I assume that you know things like the giant croissant-eating devil dog is not.
Oh, no. That conversation plus all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Filmmaker Ava DuVernay has added her voice to those supporting the Smithsonian after President Trump's efforts to try to reshape it.
We, as people who believe in justice and dignity for all, need to put the other side on the defense.
We speak with her after the summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Supreme Court has kept in place a temporary block preventing the Trump administration from deporting migrants it accuses of being members of a Venezuelan gang. NPR's Adrian Florido tells us the court said migrants targeted under the 18th century wartime law must get due process.
The case was brought by two Venezuelan men at a northern Texas detention center who were set to be deported last month under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. The ACLU filed an emergency lawsuit and blocked the deportations. The Supreme Court has rejected the government's request to be allowed to deport the migrants or any others in northern Texas, saying they must get more time to challenge their deportations. The 7-2 majority wrote that giving them about 24 hours to do that, quote, surely does not pass muster. The court has not yet ruled on whether the government's use of the Alien Enemies Act is legal. Adrian Florido, NPR News.
Commuter trains in New Jersey are at a standstill as a strike by engineers who drive the trains is affecting some 350,000 commuters. The union says it's been 5 years since engineers were given a pay raise, and they want a raise comparable to other train operators in the region. Here's New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy.
NJ Transit's employees are the backbone of our public transit system. But the workers who depend on NJ Transit are the backbone of our entire economy. They deserve a public transit system that is reliable and affordable.
The union and transit leaders agreed to a tentative contract back in March, but union membership overwhelmingly voted against the deal. New Jersey Transit serves commuters in and out of New York City and all over the Jersey area. It's the union's first strike in more than 40 years. You're listening to NPR News. The science magazine Nature announced the winners of this year's Scientist at Work photo contest. Here's NPR's Ari Daniel.
Each winning image is a dramatic, intimate portrait of research. In one, a scientist kneels in a forest, beaming at eight tiny frogs in her hands. In another, a researcher crouches atop a foggy mountain as he measures the cloud forming around him. And then there's the riveting photo that Emma Vogel, a spatial ecologist at the University of Tromsø, took aboard a little boat in a Norwegian fjord.
In the center of the photo, you see my supervisor, and he's in this bright yellow survival suit.
Behind him is a large fishing boat and hundreds of seagulls. Over his shoulder, you can just make out
a killer whale surfacing. It gives me a feeling of a dreamlike state.
Vogel studies how whales interact with fisheries. To her, this image captures the patient intensity of fieldwork. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
A California hiker missing for nearly a month has been found alive in the Sierra Mountains. Tiffany Slayton says she lost everything, had to endure an avalanche, mudslides, even a snowstorm while foraging for food. Slayton says she came across an unlocked cabin where she was able to take refuge and was found by the cabin's owner, who said he will leave one of his cabins unlocked in the future so hikers can use it in emergencies. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments,
As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ilsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump just ended a four-day whirlwind trip to the Middle East, and he was greeted like royalty. From parades of camels to sparkling palaces, the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates set out to impress the U.S. president. And they did. Joining us now to talk about the president's trip is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Elsa.
Okay, so what did you think President Trump got out of this trip?
Well, Trump said that this was all about deals, deals involving money and investments for the United States. Everywhere he went, seemingly, there was another multi-billion dollar agreement, you know, whether it was arms or energy deals, an investment in artificial intelligence or planes bought and given.
Yeah, can we talk about the plane? Because it dominated so much of this trip. I'm talking about the $400 million 747 that Qatar gifted the president, right? So much drama around this jet. Tell us more.
Yeah, it really overshadowed the entire trip. You know, Trump wants this, quote, flying palace to replace the aging Air Force One. That's despite already having ordered new ones being made by Boeing. But the president has grown frustrated with how long it's taking. And frankly, I just think he really likes the plane. 9 bathrooms, swanky lounge areas. Sounds pretty nice.
Not too shabby, I guess. But this stoked a huge amount of controversy, right?
And for good reason. Ethics watchdogs see this as corruption and a clear violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, barring the taking of such gifts. Plus, it's not even a gift for future presidents because Trump says he's going to take it and put it in his presidential library when his term is done. Members of his own party have raised concerns, too, especially related to security and saying that they don't trust the Qataris. One Republican senator even likened it to the Greek Trojan horse. For others, it rubs them the wrong way because it's coming at a time when the president's approval ratings have hit a low and Trump's asking Americans for austerity when it comes to how many dolls or pencils to buy kids because of his trade wars. And yet he says he'd be stupid not to accept a $400 million plane for free.
Well, OK, big picture here, Domenico. How was this trip to the Middle East different from those of past presidents, you think?
Yeah, I mean, incredibly so. You know, Trump made a major pivot away from U.S. moral leadership and toward the transactional. Here he was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, critical of the West.
And it's crucial for the wider world to note this great transformation has not come from Western interventionalists or flying people in beautiful planes giving you lectures on how to live and how to govern your own affairs. No. The gleaming marvels of Riyadh and Abu Dhabi were not created by the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits.
Yeah, well, Trump's description there of the Middle East, how it attained its wealth, was really pretty reductive and simplistic, ignored human rights issues, the rights of women, suppression of dissent, free and fair elections. For Trump, none of that is really important. Unlike past presidents, he doesn't see it as necessary or important for the U.S. to stand on principle and evangelize democracy. Instead, it's all about money, how to make it, how to take it.
That said, Trump couldn't completely avoid the major international issues, right? Like, what was your takeaway from how he addressed things like the wars in Gaza or in Ukraine?
Yeah, Trump again floated the idea of the U.S. taking over Gaza, but hearing from Gulf state leaders, he also acknowledged the suffering among Palestinians, though he didn't have specific remedies, and who knows what he's going to do going forward. Ukraine matters on this trip because delegations from Ukraine, the U.S., and Russia were meeting today in Turkey. But while Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was there, Russian President Vladimir Putin was a no-show. In fact, Russia sent a very junior-level diplomatic delegation. You have to wonder how long Trump is going to have patience with Putin while he continues to try and advance in Ukraine. The fact is, Trump made a lot of big promises during the campaign about ending the wars in Gaza and Ukraine, but has not been able to deliver. He's running into some big personalities with Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who so far are not bending to Trump's will.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you, Domenico.
You're welcome.
Now, a closer look at what's been happening with the delegations from Russia and Ukraine. They held direct talks in Istanbul, Turkey, today. That meeting came a day later than planned and with lowered expectations given the absence of high-level political leaders in the room. Even so, the peace negotiations were the first between Moscow and Kyiv since the early months of Russia's full-scale invasion in 2022. Joining us now is NPR's Charles Maines, who has been following these events from Moscow. Hi there.
I wanna.
So, Charles, I gather that this was not exactly a smooth process getting these delegations together. Tell us why.
No, it was not. You know, these talks were supposed to start Thursday, but were derailed by news that President Vladimir Putin of Russia would not be joining, despite having been the one to propose the idea. Instead, Putin announced last minute a mid-level group, I would call, of technocrats were representing Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who traveled to Turkey and challenged Putin to show up as well, made no secret he thought this showed Putin wasn't serious about the negotiations, or for that matter, a ceasefire. Here he is speaking to on the sidelines of a summit of European leaders in Albania today.
And if the Russian representatives in Istanbul today cannot even agree to that, to ceasefire, to this clearly necessary first step, then it will be 100% clear that Putin continues to undermine diplomacy.
But Charles, of course, these two delegations, they did finally meet. So what came out of it?
Well, yeah, for less than 2 hours behind closed doors, and there were some signs of progress, including a deal for a mass prisoner swap, 1,000 prisoners from each side, also an agreement to exchange competing ceasefire proposals as a basis for further discussions. And the head of the Russian delegation, a presidential aide Vladimir Medinsky, also had this to say. So here Medinsky says that on the whole, the Russian delegation was satisfied with the results of the meeting, and not only that, they were ready to continue contacts with Ukraine. So arguably, these are all good things. The problem here was there were high expectations going into Istanbul. You know, Putin presented these talks as a surprise counteroffer to Western demands. He signed an immediate 30-day ceasefire or face massive new sanctions. You know, that implied some new flexibility for some people. And so many thought today's meetings from the beginning were less about what was accomplished and more about who didn't bother to show, about the deal that wasn't made.
Right. And to that point, another question mark looming over all of this was whether President Trump, who was on the Middle East on an official trip, might make a cameo.
Yeah, Trump said he might stop by if he thought it would help close a deal. Obviously, he didn't in the end. Was that because he thought Putin wouldn't come, or was it the other way around? We just don't know. Either way, Trump and others, such as his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, say that it'll take Trump now and Putin in a room to hammer out a real peace deal. And this is really music to Moscow's ears. The Kremlin has always portrayed the war in Ukraine as part of a wider conflict between Russia and the West.
So help us understand where things might go from here.
Well, this prisoner exchange may happen in the next few days. That's good news. Russia and Ukraine talks may very well make progress for these ceasefire proposals as well. The question is whether Putin has inflicted damage elsewhere. You know, the Europeans are clearly incensed at what they see as Putin feigning diplomacy while he maximizes leverage on the battlefield. They say they'll now move forward with more sanctions and tariffs against key Russian exports. But the bigger issue is how Trump reacts. You know, the U.S. had threatened to join the Europeans if it didn't see a ceasefire. What does Trump do now, and who does he blame? Really remains elusive. Is it Russia, Ukraine, or both?
NPR's Charles Maines speaking with us from Moscow. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. The composer of musicals Bye Bye Birdie, Applause, and Annie has died at 96. Charles Strauss spent his last hours at home in New York. And if you don't know the name, you may well know the music. Jeff London reports.
Charles Strauss was a musical chameleon, says theater historian Lawrence Maslin.
Strauss was a great craftsperson. He adopted and adapted his vocabulary to whatever the needs of the particular genre were.
He could write songs in the style of early rock and roll.
Oh, one last kiss. Oh, give me one last kiss.
Or Depression era New York.
Hey, Hobelman, hey, Dapper Dan. You both got your style, but brother, you're never fully dressed without a smile.
Or ultra groovy 1970s New York. Strauss was classically trained at the Eastman School of Music and worked with American composer Aaron Copland. He was making a living playing rehearsal piano for Broadway shows when a stage manager who wanted to be a producer approached him, he told me in 2008.
He said to me, "I hear you write music." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "I have an idea for a show about teenagers. Would I be interested?" I said, "Would I?"
The show was Bye Bye Birdie. It opened in 1960, and even though the New York Times gave it a pan, calling it neither fish nor fowl nor musical comedy, it became an enormous hit, winning the Tony for Best Musical. And since then, it's been one of the most performed shows in community theaters and high schools.
It's a wonderful feeling, and I am modest, though not humble or any way, but I'm a very lucky man.
And he became a very rich man. Though he suffered a string of flops afterwards, Strauss had another Tony Award-winning smash with Applause, a musical version of All About Eve, in 1970.
Because you've had a taste of the sound that says love. Applause, applause, applause.
Strauss heard even more applause and won a Tony Award for Best Score with Annie, based on the comic strip Little Orphan Annie, in 1977. He said the best-known song from that score, Tomorrow, was written in rehearsal to cover a set change.
She found the dog, and she had to, in 12 seconds, let's say, get back to the orphanage. So we needed a song there.
The sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow. Come what may. Tomorrow, tomorrow, I love you. Tomorrow, you're always a day away.
Andrea McArdle was 12 years old when she starred in Annie.
My favorite thing was to listen to him play his songs. Not every composer is as charming as Charles Strauss is when he plays his music.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face.
The composer kept working into his 80s on new projects at a time when most creators would have been happy resting on their accomplishments.
I love composing. I love it, you know, and if I'm not composing, if I don't have a new project or something, I'm rather at a loss of what to do.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The performing arts group Shenyun has been accused of forced child labor in a lawsuit filed by two former dancers. The dance company firmly denies the allegations. Meanwhile, the dancers spoke to NPR's Juliana Kim about their time at Shenyun and the experiences that led to the lawsuit.
Shenyun has performed on some of the world's most prestigious stages, like New York's Lincoln Center and Washington, D.C.'s Kennedy Center. The company says over 1 million people watch its shows each year, amazed by the colorful and synchronized performances. But for two former dancers, Cheng Qingling and Sun Zan, Shenyun brings painful memories, their lawsuit alleges, of being isolated from their families, having to perform while injured, and being physically and psychologically abused. Here's Cheng.
I was in such a survival mode that I was focused on not passing out in class. Oh, thank God, at least I'm not the one that's being hit this time. Oh, thank God, I'm not being verbally abused this time.
She left her family in New Zealand and moved to New York to join Shenyun in 2010 when she was just 13. Dance was never her dream, but she wanted to make her mother proud. At the time, her mother was a devoted follower of Falun Gong, a spiritual movement founded by the same man who leads Shenyun. Meanwhile, Sun joined the dance company in 2008 at age 15. The lawsuit described how at one point early in his training, the instructors forced Sun into a side split, causing internal bleeding and several tears to his leg muscles. Sun told NPR he's still recovering from the physical and emotional toll of his childhood.
You think you can kind of run away from this, but you actually can't, you know? You're so hurt and so damaged.
Back in November, a similar complaint accusing the company of abuse was filed by another former dancer. Both lawsuits came after a sweeping New York Times investigation looking into the Shenyun enterprise and its treatment of young performers. When I asked Sun why he wanted to pursue legal action after all these years, he said this.
I just wanted to be the person that should have been there when I was a kid.
Shenyun says its success depends on keeping dancers healthy, and they ensure their performers have access to medical care during both rehearsals and on tour. The company also argues that it's been under attack by the Chinese Communist Party for decades through harassment and disinformation because its performances are centered around Chinese culture before communism. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
Last week, the Smithsonian National Museum of American History recognized the filmmaker Ava DuVernay with the Lifetime Achievement Award. That's where she gave a short speech.
At a time when truth itself is under revision and fear feels like an animating force, fear of mirrors, fear of memory, fear of the full American story told in its dazzling complexity and devastating contradictions.
People in that room knew that much of her work documents or dramatizes the history of Black Americans, like the Civil Rights Movement, the prison system, the 1989 Central Park jogger case, or the activism of football player Colin Kaepernick. And people in that room also knew that President Trump had recently issued an executive order accusing the Smithsonian Institution of divisive, race-centered ideology and directing officials to remove improper ideology from its properties. Ava DuVernay joins us now to talk about all of this. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well. Ava, I just want to start. You wrote recently in your Substack newsletter that you were a bit hesitant, anxious to make the speech that you gave there at the Smithsonian American History Museum. Tell us why.
You know, it was really a desire not to stir up any challenges for the great people who lead that institution. And the tension between, you know, not wanting to cause them any additional challenges and wanting to say what I felt needed to be said.
You said that the Smithsonian has done what America must continue to do, and I'm quoting here, confront the contradictions in our founding, illuminate the fault lines in our systems, and still hold space for grace, for grit, for growth, for greatness. Can you say a bit more about what sounds to me like a defense of the Smithsonian's role in our society, its history exhibitions?
You know what? I don't even know if it's a defense. I feel like I want to get out of a posture of having to defend what is what is known, what is good, what is right. We, as people who believe in justice and dignity for all, need to put the other side on the defense. If you are, you know, saying that the idea of including everyone's history, of having diverse points of view, of, you know, believing in and striving for equity and equality, if you believe that all of those things are not right, then you should tell us why that's the case.
I'd like to ask you, if I can, about some of the specific language that President Trump's executive order uses. It reads, and I'm quoting here, "Rather than fostering unity and a deeper understanding of our shared past, the widespread effort to rewrite history deepens societal divides and fosters a sense of national shame," end quote. Whether or not the Smithsonian is rewriting anything, I guess I want to ask, should Americans feel shame for the unjust chapters of American history that we know to be true?
I feel that assigning what folks should experience is not the issue. Mm-hmm. The issue is what happened. And what the executive order asks of us is to not even know what happened. You can feel however you feel about it. I don't feel shame about it. I feel something very different. Some may feel shame, some may feel guilt, some may feel vindication, some may feel a curiosity piqued, some may feel a sense of relief. The point is, it should be known and it should be considered.
Zooming out a bit here, we are about 5 years out from a summer where across this country, people of all colors, of all ages and genders took to the streets. They protested systemic racism that were prompted by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And 5 years later, President Trump has returned to the White House. He is waging a fight to rid the government of DEI programs. He has targeted so-called woke ideology, as he and his allies call it. How do you think about that shift and what we have seen happen across this country in the last 5 years?
It's been a whirlwind of ideas, of objections, of opinions. And I think all of that is healthy if it is allowed to all be heard, seen, valued, and in the mix. But when the balance starts to tilt, and when one point of view starts to purposely, deliberately, intentionally drown out the realities and experiences of other people, we get into a real danger zone. And I think that when you have an opportunity to be at a microphone, wherever you are, and there's someone who will listen, it's important to raise your voice and to say, there's a different way, there's another way.
Ava DuVernay, Oscar nominee, Emmy winner, and recent recipient of the Great Americans Medal from the Smithsonian Museum of American History. Thank you so much.
Thank you for what you do. Appreciate you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Workday, Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries.